Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Our guest this week is Ramona Shelburne, who has approximately 75,000 jobs at ESPN. She is a writer, a reporter. She's on studio shows up and down the block. Ramona, there's so much going on this week with Summer League and the ESPYs. We're wrapping up the free agency and the trade season. And that was crazier than maybe ever this year. With the Summer League, though, especially with the Lonzo Ball games, can you ever remember a time where there was this much national general interest in what was going on at this point?
Well, I think this is kind of like the NBA in general. I think the NBA is just mushrooming right now, and it's because they've embraced everything. Like, they embrace social media, they embraced controversy. They embraced conflict. Like, they don't run from it, and I think they have fun with it. I mean, even just look at De'Aaron Fox yesterday, where he tweets out the thing, you know, the shake in my head, the face palm after Lonzo Ball is going to sit out, and then deletes it. And we're like, oh, did somebody get to him, some handler? And then after the game, he, like, made a joke about being hacked and, like, understanding that the media was going to eat that up and love it and have fun with it. And, like, he's 19. Like, he gets it already. Like, he already gets how to have fun with this kind of stuff. And I just, you know, I think that's because the NBA, more than probably any other sport or any other league right now, is, like, embraced the culture sort of in a lot of ways. They're setting media culture, and they're setting the, you know, they're right in pace with their fans. And so I think that's partially why the popularity's exploded so much, because they're connecting sort of where the fans are. I mean, that's what we all talk about in media, is that you got to meet the fans where they are. The NBA does that.
Yeah, you mentioned the Fox and the Lonzo Ball thing. Has anybody's performance ever been scrutinized on a Summer League game to Summer League game basis like Lonzo Ball's this year? I can't ever remember anything like this.
Well, I mean, I like to stay away from hyperbole, right? Because I just, you know, I go back a ways. And, like, I remember covering the Shaq Kobe Lakers, and everything was magnified then, too. It's just magnified in a different way. We didn't have Twitter. Like, can you imagine the Shaq Kobe wars during the Twitter era? Right? It would have been off the hook. Lonzo Ball Summer League game, yeah, it was scrutinized. But, like, back in the day when the Lakers drafted Kobe Bryant, like, he was playing summer league games at the Long Beach Pyramid. It was a big deal. I mean, or you know, even the last few years, summer league's been getting more and more and more. But I will say this, like, I was out at dinner with a bunch of our ESPN crew, and Nick Friedel, who covers the Bulls for us, and I were there, and he said, God, do you remember just like 5 years ago when it was just you and me here? And I was like, that's right. And I remember he was covering the Bulls, and Derrick Rose was part of the Bulls back then. So ESPN Chicago would send Nick Friedel out just to, like, cover Derrick Rose, right? And it was Summer League, USA Basketball. Like, it was all kind of, you know, that was the two Vegas trips that people would do. And I remember there was a players union meeting, and Nick was there. And it was kind of like he was literally the only writer there. And then I actually had driven out because I was playing, like, in an all-night softball tournament because I just thought it'd be fun. And I remember going to, like, USA Basketball had their camp at the same time, right around the same time. And it was like, they were like, well, could you think, you know, you can pop in and write a news story or something while you're there? Okay. And, like, now we're at a dinner with, like, 12 people, and we're all working, and we're all filing stories, and we're all doing stuff, and we're on TV or whatever it is. And, like, I mean, just the amount, and, like, that was like 5 years ago. It really wasn't that, you know, that long of a period of time, but, like, that's how much the NBA during the off season has grown.
Oh, I totally agree with that. You've covered the Ball family a lot, especially over the last few months. And mm-hmm. You wrote a very fascinating profile last week, and I was just amazed that you got Magic Johnson on the record saying, and I'm paraphrasing him, that he was concerned with LaVar Ball for a lot of the stretch of the last few months, but since he had the second pick, he was 80% sure he was going to go with Lonzo. And he had a meeting with LaVar, and LaVar assured him that he's just, in effect, playing up a character for marketing purposes. And not only did LaVar tell Magic that, but Magic told you that with his name attached to it. And a quote like that is kind of rare from a person in Magic's position. Were you surprised when you were talking to him and he said that on the record?
No. I mean, I knew he had said it to both Magic and Rob Pelinka because they had told me that, you know, in and around the draft. And, you know, I was covering the draft all the way through. And, you know, what made you guys decide that you were cool with this? And I knew they had... They really like Lonzo as a player. I think they had concerns about a shot, like could he make it in the, you know, they wanted to see the form, they wanted to see, get to know the kid a little bit, just so you could understand, like, would he be coachable, you know, what was the personality, and how was that going to translate, and how would they connect to him. But I think they did have some thoughts about how LaVar would affect the Lakers and affect Lonzo, and how this whole thing would go, and it helped to meet him on his own turf, and talk to him man-to-man, but I think it really helped that LaVar had the presence and the self-consciousness to say that to them, right? That he volunteered it. It's not like Magic said that and LaVar responded that. LaVar really leveled with him. And so I had known that before, like right around the draft, and I said, okay, well, if I'm going to write the story, I'm going to get him to say it on the record. Like, I'm not going to just write it like sources said or write it like I know it. Like, they got to say it on the record. So LaVar actually, he didn't use the same term, it's all marketing, but I ran that version of their conversation by all of them, by Rob Pelinka, by Magic, by LaVar. And I think, like, they, once people know that you know the truth, like, they, it's harder for them to lie to you, right? Like, I already know what was said. So both of them, you know, confirmed it in their own way. I mean, Magic said, I already knew that. Yeah, it was all Mario, just assumed it. But I think it really did help that LaVar looked them both in the eye and said, look, you know, when Lonzo goes to LA, I'm still going to be out here in Chino training kids here. And I'm, you know, I have my two younger boys. Like, I'm, you know, obviously he's building Big Baller Brand and he has aspirations that way. And he'll probably be like a recurring character on WWE at the rate he's going. But like, I think he understands that he's taken Lonzo as far as he can basketball wise. And that, like, you know, for him to really win now, like, this only works if Lonzo's good. This only works if Lonzo performs. And, like, he knows he needs the Lakers to do that. He needs them to kind of carry him across the finish line here.
This is going to sound like a little bit of a weird question. I don't want to say it sound confusing. I just want to sound curious. How did LaVar initially in his career make money so that he was able to buy this house that they always show? Mm-hmm. Chino with the basketball court, because I know he had a marginal football career, and I assume that he makes some money now through the AAU and basketball circuits and through Big Baller Brand, but there's a gap where I'm intellectually curious of what he did for a living.
Yeah, well, I mean, his story, okay, and so on some level you have to, like, you know, you have to take his word for it and put his name on it, right? And he says that, right? His story is that he made enough money in his football career to pay for that house basically outright. And he has this philosophy of, like, you buy things outright so you don't owe anybody anything and I'm ahead. And, I did actually go and try to look up, like, how much they paid for the house back when they bought it. And it seems in line with what he said. You know, we're not able to, I can't pull exactly like bank statements, right? You can't do that. And we checked them out to see if he had any like bankruptcies or he had any other liens on it against him or his business, and I didn't see any of that. So I actually think that's, you know, that's a fair question, and it's a different story than the one I was writing, but I would assume the bigger this gets, and especially with two kids who are still amateurs, right, and there's still issues with amateurism at UCLA, I would assume that people would continue to dig right along that line of questioning, right? Where does all that come from? But what he says is, and I don't have reason to doubt it, is that he used the money that he made in all those training camps. He sent it home to Tina, his wife, and she picked that house for them. And I guess back in the day, and you looked at what that lined up with how much he said he made, and that lined up and on that level. And then since then, his wife was a teacher, so she had a teacher salary, and he was a trainer, and he charges a certain amount per hour. And I saw the kids come by from the neighborhood, and there's, I don't know, 10, 15 kids every single day that come by and they pay, I can't remember what the hourly rate was, but let's make something up and say it's, you know, $25, $30 an hour or something. So that's, you know, I guess you could add that up that way. And that's their income. And I guess if you don't have a house payment and all you're doing is supporting your family and you have a teacher salary, it could work that way, right? I don't know how you afford super expensive cars or anything, but like now, there's a different revenue stream because Lonzo's an NBA player and he has other endorsements and things like that. And so I think, yeah, I don't know how they fund all of their lifestyle, but there's nothing that jumps out at you right away when you do the initial fact check.
That's a fair answer. And so with the Lakers being 80% confident they were going to pick Lonzo throughout the process, do you know, based on your understanding of your relationship with Magic and Pelinka and maybe the Buss family, did they get more concerned when LeVar had the well-publicized confrontation with Christine Leahy on the Herd, or was that not something that they maybe viewed as big of a deal as what I observed the general public did?
I don't think it was any one incident, to be honest. I think it's just the fact that he continues to make news, right? And so you don't know what the next news is going to be. You don't know what the next story is going to be. And like the thing that I felt like people in the NBA, and not just the Lakers in general, but like just anyone in the NBA you talk to about this and say, is this a problem? Was essentially, if the dad starts talking about other players in the league and especially teammates, because it's one thing to like mention something, like, you know, he had comments about the players at UCLA. I forget what the exact quote was, but it was something like, they weren't fast enough or athletic enough to play with him. And I think he may have mentioned TJ Leaf's name, if I'm not mistaken.
He said, like white players.
Yeah. It was, I can't remember the exact quote. So I don't want to misquote him, but it was something to that effect. And if you do that to college kids, that's not great. But if you do that to NBA guys, it's a problem, right? Like they're not going to take that. And I think that's the biggest area of concern is like him criticizing teammates or other guys in the league and or maybe criticizing Luke Walton or whatever it is. Like, you know, I can't really see how that could go over well at all. So that's I think their biggest area of concern. I don't think it was any one specific thing or incident or quote or whatever it is. It's just this generalized sense of, okay, let the kid play now. Let the story be about Lonzo and not about just making headlines and, like you can promote big baller brand, you do it all you want, but like there's certain areas that I think would be far more problematic.
Let's say you had to bet one way or the other. So is there a greater or less than 50% chance in your mind, not necessarily based on inside information, but based on your reporting and your intuition, what are the odds you think that LeBron joins the Lakers in the 2018 offseason?
So I personally think it's a pretty good chance. And I base that more like it's an informed speculation, but it's not, you know, it's also with the understanding that like, I don't think LeBron decides anything right now. I think LeBron has historically been a guy who gives himself a lot of options and a lot of leverage. And, you know, he's looking at potentially signing a 5-year deal in Cleveland, right? That's like the 5-year supermax contract. And, by doing that, he in some ways would be giving up his leverage on the Cavs, which he's maintained pretty well throughout his time there, where he signs these 1-1 deals where he could become a free agent. And you're also LeBron and the reason why they're winning and the reason why the franchise is valuable again. And so he's really good at maintaining his leverage and using it when he wants to use it in the ways he wants to. So if you're going to give all that up and sign the Supermax contract, right, the 5-year deal or whatever it is, and maybe he will, maybe he won't, right? But you got to feel good about the franchise. You got to feel good about the long-term prospects. You got to feel good about this being the place where you want to continue to build on your legacy and what is your legacy. Because, like, for me, that's all LeBron's next 5 years is about, is legacy. Is it about how many rings can he get? Is it about continuing to, like, put roots down in Cleveland? Like, he already brought a championship to Cleveland, so he did his stated goal. Look at the team right now. Do they look like a team that's built for the long haul? I mean, there's Kyrie Irving, but, the rest of the guys on that roster, Tristan Thompson, I guess you could say, would age well, but the rest of the guys on that roster, like, how are they going to age? And you know, they're going to continue to have to reload and revamp. And do they have a great visionary general manager in there? Do they have a great, they have stability in the front office? Not really, not from what we've seen so far. So there's a part of me that goes, if he's looking at the Cavs, is like, is this a place I want to spend the next 5 years of my career? What's keeping him there other than his ties to Cleveland? Is the next place LA? Maybe. Or maybe it's some other young team that's playing really well. Because I think LeBron only can leave again if he's going to a place where he can still win. You can't leave just to go take a trip to LA to go do movies. You can't just leave to be LeBron in LA with a bunch of kids. Like, he has to be the final piece of the puzzle. And so, do I think there's a good chance the Lakers could be that? Yeah, but I also think that let's see how they play this year. Let's see what Brandon Ingram looks like in 3 months. Let's see what Lonzo Ball looks like in 3 months. Let's see if Paul George loves it in Oklahoma City and decides to stay there with Russell. And so right now, sitting here on July, whatever day this is, I have no idea, 10th, 11th, something like that. Good chance. But so much can happen between now and then. What if Minnesota looks amazing? What if Miami looks amazing again? What if the Knicks pull off a big trade? I don't see that, but right? Anything where LeBron can look like he can go and add to his legacy, because I think it's all about how many rings can he win now. I think it's all about Chase and Jordan, and what's the final tally? I think that's where he settles in.
Is there any way to make the NBA voodoo math work for the whole Banana Boat crew to join the Lakers? So that means LeBron, Chris Paul, Carmelo, and Dwayne Wade in the summer of 18 all join up together, which they've said before that they always wanted to do. Could they pair up with Ingram and Lonzo in LA, or does it require way too much salary sacrifice on the part of one or some of them to be even feasible?
Yeah, it's hard for me to see how all four can get to one place, and it would take a lot of salary sacrifice. I think Melo could get to Cleveland fairly easily. Chris Paul could get to Cleveland fairly easily. Dwayne Wade could get to Cleveland fairly easily, but I don't know how they could all get to LA. Right? Because you have to be in one place or the other first. I don't know. To me, I don't really see the big burning desire for them all to play together. I know they're all buddies, but I think that was something that, as a theoretical, they said, yeah, that would be fun. But I don't know if they actually do really want to play together.
That makes sense. With the Rockets, they're kind of the budding super team this offseason. Mm-hmm. Chris Paul, the Thunder too, with adding Paul George, but with the Rockets, there have been talks that they might acquire Carmelo, and that just seems intellectually baffling to me, given how the Mike D'Antoni Carmelo relationship totally blew up in New York. Isn't that weird that they could put that behind them potentially?
Yeah, it's totally weird. I can't picture it at all. I mean, I remember Mike after he came to LA when he was coaching the Lakers, and he had just gotten out of a really toxic situation in New York. And I mean, if you would have asked me then, within 5 years, would Mike D'Antoni be, considering coaching Carmelo Anthony again? I would have said, absolutely not. No way, never. So Mike just won Coach of the Year. And I still can't wrap my head around the idea that he'd coach him again with the way that went in New York. But Mike is also the kind of guy that, he's an easygoing guy, and he's a survivor, right? He's been through a lot of stuff. He's okay with difficult personalities. He's dealt with a lot of them before in his careers, and his offense generally tends to make people feel good about themselves because everybody scores and everybody plays a lot. So I guess theoretically I could see it if Chris Paul really manages that relationship, which Chris would do because that's his personality, is Chris would really be the alpha there. If you know all, we're talking about four personalities, Melo, Chris, Harden, and Chris is the alpha of that, and D'Antoni is the fourth. Yeah. Chris is the alpha personality, and so I think Chris would really have to take a huge role in managing that relationship and managing the whole thing. As a 1 year experiment, I'm kind of fascinated by it, but that's also me as a, somebody who I like interesting, weird swings that people take, and I like to see how they play out. It's good copy for us. It's good storyline. It's good. It's fascinating to watch. So, poor Mike though, God, get out of New York, come to LA and have to coach. I remember him in LA with Kobe and Dwight and Hal and all that. You know, I mean, Steve Nash and how that blew up. I mean, I feel like he goes from creating this really cool thing last year around James and, like, you know, resurrecting his career, James's career, et cetera, to, like, now back to what he had in LA, which is just managing a bunch of huge superstar egos.
Switching to, like, there's a huge disparity between the East and the West, and Zach Lowe reported last week that Sarver of the Suns and Mark Cuban, obviously billionaire owner of the Mavericks, they had proposed at least tweaking the playoff seeding so that it wouldn't just be West on one side, East on the other. From a fan's perspective, wouldn't it be way more interesting if they ranked it 1 to 16, not just in the playoffs, but in the regular season, because then you're not going to see LeBron taking nights off because he doesn't want to be on the same side of the bracket as the Warriors.
Yeah, I guess that's an option. I mean, I don't know how Robert Sarver gets to have an opinion here, because, like, the Suns haven't been good in a really long time, and they're back to tanking again. But, like, you know, Mark Cuban, okay, because Cubes goes for it, you know. I think other than the fact, you know, like, he kind of admitted they were tanking last year once they were out of it, but, you know, Cuban has earned the right to say something like that. But I'm for big changes if it's, like, so obvious and clear that that's, but, like, I'm not into making huge changes to the way the NBA operates based on, like, you know, a 4-year cycle of what this looks like right now. I mean, you know, there's reasons why it's the East and the West, and a lot of it has to do with travel. And I mean, what if we have, like, Toronto against Portland in the playoffs? Like, what if we have 10 teams from the West and 6 teams from the East, or even worse? Like, what if it's 12-4? I don't know. There's, like, a part of me that's like, it's just too much change, and you start messing with stuff too much. Like, in the way I feel in baseball, with, like, interleague baseball is cool, but now it's just, like, too much interleague, right? And it's like you lose your traditions and you lose the ways of doing things. I'm for, like, more gradual change, and, like, I think let's just see how this plays out over the next little bit before we start making huge changes, sweeping changes. Because, like, we've talked about dynasties, and the NBA has had them before, and it was made the NBA better. I mean, the Lakers and Celtics, I mean, the Celtics won 10 years in a row. I mean, right? Like, this is fine. It's just, we just have to always have an opinion and hot takes right now because we have social media, and it's like you wake up in the morning and have a new one. So, like, I'm not into that right now.
In terms of, like, how much exposure there is of the league, because that, like, even in the 80s, like, which isn't that long ago, there were not many nationally televised games, and now there's just a million a week. And so when you see these games and they don't have any stakes because you know it's going to be probably the Cavs and the Warriors, it makes it difficult to get engaged with the regular season for any purposes other than, like, I don't mean to downplay it, but for any reason other than the, like, amazing athleticism of the individual players.
Yeah, although, you know what, like, I was really happy with last regular season. Like, you would have thought it would have been super boring and nobody cares and all that, but it was one of the best regular seasons we've had in a long time. And it was, you know, the race between Westbrook and Harden and LeBron and Kawhi, like, that was exciting. And, like, I know it ended up just coming down to the Warriors and Cavs again, and there wasn't all that much drama in the playoffs, and, you know, played out exactly how everybody thought it would. But, like, it was kind of a great regular season. I was pleasantly surprised. And so, like, that's, you know, and I wouldn't have thought that, you know, the Rockets would have done what they've done so far. I wouldn't have thought Oklahoma City would trade for Paul George. This is exciting. Like, and that's what's great about the NBA is they sort of embrace controversy. They sort of embrace big swings. Like, you know, you don't see that in other sports. You don't see, I mean, the NBA loves the fact that, like, we're talking about free agency in July, that they're stealing baseball's thunder right now. This is the All-Star break, and we're still talking about basketball. We're talking about summer league over the end where the baseball All-Star game. And, like, the NBA, like, once you kind of have people, like, the people my favorite to cover are people who, like, understand the game. Like, they understand that this is about the fans, and it's like controversy is not something to run away from. It's just something to deal with, and if you embrace it and have fun with it, like, it can really be a cool thing. And so I think, like, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think that it's that's why we see such a huge mushrooming of NBA popularity right now.
All right, that's all fair. Switching to your own career, so you graduate Stanford and you spent 7 years at the LA Daily News. As kind of like a cliff notes, how did you move up the ladder there and boost your profile to the point where you would then get on ESPN's radar in 2009?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I really moved up the ladder all that much, to be honest. Like, I covered preps for a long time. Like, it was a good 4 or 5 years where I was, like, out covering high school football games and basketball games. And, like, there was a time where I was about to get out of the business. I remember I was 28, 29-ish, and I was like, man, if I don't get a break pretty soon, like, I'm just going to have to do something else because I can't keep making no money and living in, you know, the one-bedroom apartment in the Valley and, like, going, you know, like, I need to kind of start my life and this, you know, and feel like I'm going in a direction. And I guess I got a couple of breaks along the way where it was just a really bad time in the industry. This was, like, the beginning of the end for newspapers, right? It was the, like, when, like, I think I might have been, like, the last person they hired, right? And everybody else was just attrition. It was just people would leave and no one would ever get hired. Like, if somebody would just leave and they'd never fill the job. So I guess, like, the way I moved up in a way was that people would leave. And, you know, you'd kind of get different opportunities. And I was always looking for, I mean, there was a time there where, like, my best opportunities were just, you know, to do anything other than cover high schools was like go out to UCLA and cover women's basketball or women's soccer or like anything that was like, you know, sometimes Howard Beck was covering the Lakers and he would need like a Saturday morning off. So I'd cover practice or, you know, I mean, there was just like, you just took whatever you could get, like any backup role or any extra little thing where you would like learn stuff. And, you know, that was like most of my 20s. Right. And I actually even took an internship at the local NBC station, and I was going to totally switch careers and try to go be a producer or something. But then I got a local, they made me like the local columnist. And that was like kind of more in my wheelhouse because I was able to write stories that I cared about as opposed to just like covering a game and writing a game recap or whatever. And I was able to kind of dig in and elevate stories. And then when you write a local column, occasionally they'll say, okay, we need a columnist at the Laker game or the Clipper game or whatever it was. And I remember, I guess I don't know if you want to call it a break, but like I started, our Clipper writer, became a desk person. He switched from covering the team and I just said, hey, can I cover the Clippers? Right? And they said, yeah, you could like cover the home games and practices and stuff. But you know, you still have to do your high school stuff. Right. Yeah. So I just kind of did it. I just like would just go out there and cover the Clippers. And that was the year that they had, I was on the team back. Oh, that was the year Baron Davis was there and Zach Randolph was there. And they ended up being so bad that they got the number one pick and got Blake Griffin. So that was back in those days. And that was most of my experience with the NBA. And then because I was around the NBA a little bit, the Lakers, I think that was the same year they made a run pretty deep into the playoffs. And I covered them all the way through. I was like, Elliot Tiefer was our beat writer back then, and I got to be his backup. So you just kind of, I just like, wherever I could hook on and get any kind of a chance to do more than the high school stuff, I did it. And I have like very distinct memories of like having to do my high school softball roundup in the press room at Staples Center, like after I finished my sidebar on the Lakers playoff game, right? Like, yeah. Coming from high school track meet and then like rushing down to make the game. I mean, it was a very like double duty thing. And so eventually I got to do more NBA stuff and I got a few more opportunities. And then this is like the sad story. And I hate the fact that this is actually the reason, but we laid off one of our main columnists and he was like a really good friend of mine and one of my mentors. And it was awful. Like, and I remember they were like, well, this is what's happening here. And we want you to replace him. And I was like, well, that's horrible. Like, I don't want to get my job that way. So we let a little time go by before that officially happened. But that's sort of how I got to be the lead columnist of the Daily News. I mean, it's like kind of an ugly way of getting a job, right? You know, you just it is what it's. But I got it, and I remember it feeling kind of fraudulent at first because I was like, wow, I've never really done a beat. I've never really done a big thing, but back in those days, there was a path to becoming a columnist. Like you covered two or three different beats. And by the time you got in your 40s or 50s, then you were deemed like seasoned enough or experienced enough to have an opinion and have the gravitas to write a column and have an opinion on things. And like now, when people come out of college and they have opinions on things, like, and they write really strong hot takes when they're 22. But back then I was like, well, who am I? What? Who's going to respect my column? You know, who's going to respect me? It's like, I'm like 30. And, you know, I went from being like just any scrappy thing I could do to like, now you're the lead columnist. And I had to get over this idea that I didn't deserve it, that I hadn't earned it. It took me a little while. And I always remember this. I was saying this to Elliot Tiefert, who was one of my buddies and a good mentor back in the day. He was covering the Lakers. I said, Elliot, like, I mean, I went from writing I was the backup covering when you couldn't make practice, or, you know, writing the sidebar, running quotes, to like now I'm writing the lead column. And I'm like, I how do I do this? And he's like, well, see the pool over there? And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, just jump in and swim. I was like, okay. So that's what I did. And then once you start writing columns, you want to make them good, and you start reporting, and you kind of overwork to sort of maybe overcompensate for your lack of experience.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, you do a bunch of different things for ESPN.
Uh-huh.
What do you get the most exhilaration out of? Is it a deeply reported feature, maybe on like the Balls, or how Jeannie Buss comes to control the Lakers, or Ronda Rousey? Mm-hmm. Existential anxieties, or is it like breaking monster news, like when you broke the Paul George trade to Oklahoma City a week or two ago? Or is it when you're on TV in like a frenetic atmosphere, like for example that free agency special right after you broke the Paul George news, and things are moving at a breakneck pace and you're responding to it on television? What gives you the most sense of like personal fulfillment and satisfaction with your job?
Okay, so I would definitely say when I get to write, when I get to stretch out and write something big and deep and, you know, meaningful, those are really hard. Okay. Like if that was my whole life, I would be a miserable person and no one would want to be around me or be my friend or be married to me or anything. Cause it's a really hard life to just be a writer, to like really dive in and like, that's your whole existence. Cause like writing is hard. It's really hard. Like I have to go, and when I go and do a story like that, I love the part where you're reporting it, where you hang out and you build, you know, you see that world. Like, so with Rhonda, I spent 2 or 3 months like going to the gym and just showing up. And some days I would ask questions. Some days I just observe, and you know, because you have to find the story, right? And you have to find you see everything. Yeah. I don't like writing definitive stories based on meeting somebody for an hour at lunch, you know, and then I have to make the whole scene out of like what kind of salad they had, right? Or what kind of, you know, drink they ordered, you know, like that's not all that revealing. That's just like quick flash on who it is, right? You don't know somebody in like one lunch, right? You get just a flash. Okay. So I love that part of it. And then I love talking with my editor about it. And I do love parts of the writing process. Like, but a lot of it's just really hard. So I usually like go to a hotel and I like check in and I stay for 3 or 4 days and I just stay up all night writing, and then I sleep a little during the day and then I try it again. And I have to like have separation from the world to write like that. And like, you have to just really be in that story and connect to it. And then I get like different, I pick up different playlist music, and I have certain songs that I'll just listen to 500 times in a row because it feels like what the story is about. I mean, like in retrospect, it sounds really glamorous and fun, but in the moment, it's horrible. Right? So, like, I don't think I could have that as a healthy lifestyle and only do that. So that's why I've always liked jumping around. Like, I like, you know, do that, and then like next week, I don't want to dive into anything for like a month. I want to just, you know, host radio shows and pop in and do Around the Horn and pop in and do Sports Nation or whatever. Do the jump, like that stuff to me is like. Like that feels like an easy day, right? You just show up and be yourself and know your stuff, and that feels like I'm having fun that day, right? But I don't want to just have fun. I also want to challenge myself. So I guess the long way of answering your question is there is no something I get the most joy out of. I mean, you get the most joy out of challenges and overcoming them and pushing yourself and seeing what's inside you, but. I couldn't do that, and I couldn't be that speed and that that level of intensity like all the time, or I would not have a good life. So.
We've got 3 minutes till you're hard out. Is there anything that we didn't discuss in this last half hour that you think is like fascinating and you want to use this time and platform to talk about?
Let's think about that. I know I usually end a lot of interviews with that question too, because I always think that sometimes people have an idea of, you know, of what that is important to them. You know, I guess I'll just like, I'll pivot and just say that it's, you know, a lot of high school or college kids or people who want to get into the business always come and say like, what's your advice? Right. That's the, what's your advice if I want to get into this? And my general answer is nobody really knows what's happening in the industry right now. Like nobody knows what's happening in general or where any of us will be 5 years from now. But there's something about like you, there is something in your gut that tells you like this works, right? Like when you do something that's working or when you do something that's good, like you always feel it. And at that point, you just sort of have to trust it. Like you'll find this sweet spot. And I'll go back to like my athletic career. When you hit the ball on the nose, you're in the zone, right? You hit it and you're good and you just have to trust it. So I think a lot of what I hope happens in the industry is that people keep doing that. Like a lot of the stuff that we've seen as breakthrough writers, breakthrough content type things are because somebody had something they just were passionate about and they were doing it. And at first, maybe they didn't see it, but like, you know, like we have this podcast that's going around you know, a bunch of the guys from the True Hoop Network, Jade Hoy and Amin El-Hassan, and those guys started this podcast thing. And for a while, it was just like them and they were goofing around. And now it's become this like huge thing where they're having live events and they're showing up and doing, like people are showing, they believed in it and they had fun. And so I hope we just do a little more of that in the industry. I hope we just like try different things and not go the way of the, you know, the movie studios where they just make sequels to everything, right? Like just do content that cuts through and that in your gut, you know it works.
Thanks so much, Ramona. Really appreciate you making time for us in the middle of a very busy stretch. Hope to talk with you again a month to 3 months down the road.
Sounds good. All right. I have a very busy stretch where I'm just, it's ESPYs week, right? So it's just like, I know everyone's going to feel really sad for us that we have to go to lots of ESPYs events, right? And parties and get dressed up and get our hair and makeup. And that's really tough life, right? Lots of lunches and smooching.
Thanks again. We'll talk.
Thanks.
I don't notice you.